WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. Peter Falk is famous worldwide for portraying one of television's most iconic characters, Lieutenant Columbo, the detective with a tattered raincoat, a sharp mind, and a very persistent nature. Falk has been playing Columbo off and on since 1968. We'll hear Falk discussing his Columbo character later in the show, but right now we'll hear about his film work with John Cassavetes. Falk co-starred in The Director's Husbands and A Woman Under the Influence and was well-suited to the wide range of comedy and drama and the various levels of improvisation that those parts demanded. Terry spoke with Peter Falk in 1995 and asked him about working with Cassavetes.
What struck you as different about his approach to directing
everything,
than what you were used to?
Everything. Everything John did was original. Everything. Every bone in his body was original. He was the most fertile man I've ever met. I'll never meet anyone as fertile as he was. I mean, he's changed the face of filmmaking and in every way, not only in form, but in content, everything. John was something. John saw the dawn about 2 hours before everybody else. John's first picture was called Faces. I think he made it in 56, maybe 57. And that was maybe 10 years before anybody ever heard of Martin Luther King. Now, here's John. He's 25 years old. He's making his first picture. And the theme of it has to do with a black and white relationship, male, female, black, white. He was ahead of his time, John.
When you improvise with Cassavetes in a movie, what was the process of improvisation like?
There's much less improvisation in his movies than people think. I could make a lot of money if I would bet somebody. I said, you point out the scenes to me that are improvised, and when you're wrong, you pay me, and when you're right, I'll pay you. You can't tell the difference between what's improvised and what isn't improvised in John's scenes. John introduced a new standard of spontaneity, a new standard of spontaneous behavior in acting. Nobody did that before. He started that. There were times when John would want you to improvise. There were other times where it was strictly written and you were expected to follow the script.
Working with Cassavetes, did that bring out a certain spontaneity in you, in your performances?
Oh, yeah, if it did. If it took me a long time to trust him. Because actors, we have our own idea about how we act. And you rely on... technique has a lot to do with acting. Technique has a lot to do with the craft of acting. And that's the one thing John didn't want to... I mean, he didn't want you to be technical, even in the best sense. You can get an actor who's an extremely capable, technical actor, and nobody can tell the difference.
What strikes me with Cassavetes' movies, one of the many things that make them different, is that there's a lot more, everything's slower, there's more space around actions and words. A lot of movies, especially now, are so tightly edited and so quickly paced. But, you know, there's silences and pauses and... just a lot of room, and I was wondering if that made it made you pace yourself differently in a performance, knowing that the camera was going to be on you maybe for a longer time, and in moments that to another director might seem like an off moment and not an on moment.
Yeah, that's the one thing John never wanted you to think about, and the way he directed prevented you from thinking about that, whether or not you are going to take more space or whether you're going to take less space or whether this scene called for... whatever, this kind of mood or that kind of mood. He was trying to get you to get rid of all that crap. Just behave. Behave. Let me worry about it later on. And then he would cut the scene. But while you were doing it, He wouldn't let you do that. He'd put a banana up his ass and run around in front of you. He'd do anything to make you off balance.
Did he actually do that?
Oh, he did worse.
Oh.
He would do anything. He would do anything to stop you from thinking. He would do anything to stop you from trying to figure out, how am I going to do this? And he would never tell you anything. And the reason he wouldn't tell you anything was because he was afraid of words. He was afraid that those words would then be retranslated into some cliche.
Well, why wouldn't he tell you? He didn't want you thinking.
He didn't want you thinking. And if you start talking about what the character is feeling, you do have that danger of saying, oh, I understand now. This is how you play embarrassment. And you play it the way you've seen somebody else play it, or you have some idea of how to play it. And what usually happens is that the behavior lacks the ambiguity that most behavior has, where it's not just, there are different kinds of anger, there are different kinds of charm. They're not all the same, and there's mixtures involved at any given moment in time. And I think that's why the behavior in his picture is, to me at any rate, more interesting. So he wouldn't tell you anything.
So this threw you off balance, having technique taken away from you.
Yes. And I was off balance, and I was irritated, and I was angry, and I was afraid, and I was nervous. I was all those things.
Was there a turning point where you started to think, oh, I get it now, I can make this work, or I could work within this kind of...
I didn't get to that. I didn't really get to that turning point. Actually, we'd finished Husbands, and I was still uncertain. And the reason I did Woman Under the Influence is because I looked in a mirror once, and I said to myself, you know, you might be wrong, Peter. He might be right. I'm going to try it again. And that's why I made Woman Under the Influence. I wanted to go again with him. Just to see.
And what changed for you in that film?
Well, I trusted him even more, and I understood a little bit more about the way he was trying to do things. That was John's problem. Nobody could understand why he was trying to do it. He had to break everybody down. And he did. And it was good that he did. And he was able to do it.
Peter Falk, speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. We'll continue the interview in a moment, and when we do, he'll talk about Columbo. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Peter Falk, who played Lieutenant Columbo, one of the most famous characters in the history of television, right up there with Ralph Cramden, Lucy Ricardo, and Archie Bunker. But Peter Falk's character was, and is, different. Those other characters all came from sitcoms. Columbo's equally quirky character was the central figure in a mystery drama, and that character has clocked more years on TV than Ralph, Lucy, and Archie combined. The first season of Columbo, including the 1968 prescription murder telemovie that introduced the character, has just been released on DVD by Universal. Here's a scene from Prescription Murder with some of Columbo's now famous mannerisms already in evidence.
Well, listen, there's one more thing. You don't remember what your wife was wearing that night, do you?
Well, Carol had so many dresses. Is it important?
Well, yes, in a way it is.
Let's see now. Oh, yes, she was wearing a blue wool dress with brass buttons, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what the stewardess said. She's back in town, by the way, and I spoke to her, and she told me your wife was wearing a blue wool dress with blue kid gloves.
Well, and that's probably it.
No. That's funny, though. If she came home from the airport, what did she do with the dress and gloves? When we went over your apartment last week, we couldn't find them.
Well, they may have been stolen.
Yeah, maybe. Did you put those on the list of stolen items?
Really, Lieutenant, how could you expect me to notice they were missing?
Still, it's puzzling when you think about it. I mean, why would a guy steal a dress and a pair of gloves? What are they worth?
People don't always do the rational thing.
Oh, they sure don't. You learn a lot about that in my line. Well, I guess you do in yours, too.
What was the part of Columbo like when you first read it?
It was very good. It was somebody that I immediately wanted to play. But the basic thrust of a guy appearing less than he actually is, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that disarming quality of not ever appearing formidable was always there. I think that when we started to make the series, they would often write scenes that were supposed to be humorous. And those are the ones that made me very, very nervous.
Why?
Because I didn't think they were funny. They were kind of cute. And so I would tamper with those all the time to make sure that they were funny, that they were humorous, not funny, and that they were more subtle and more believable. And the other thing that I guess I insisted upon was that I think that he is by birth a polite man, but he's also canny. So he's not above using his politeness. But the fact that he is polite makes it easier for him to play polite. And the other thing that used to bother me about the early scripts, not the early scripts, any of the scripts, was in the final scene, if you had what actors used to refer to as Moshe the Explainer scenes. That's when the detective, he takes 2 pages, he talks for 2 pages and he explains everything that happened. And as the actor, you can hear the people snoring. You know the audience is tuned out, they're not interested. So the trick is to have that final scene remain a scene and have the cat and mouse going back and forth, and the audience plus the villain, they don't know what in the hell this guy's driving at, but they're interested. You show them just enough to keep them interested, keep them guessing what is he going to do. And when you finally nail the guy, that should be the end of the show. It should be about 3 lines after that, and that's it. It was things like that that used to... And clues. The clues can't be transparent. And if they're obvious to the audience, then he's not Sherlock Holmes.
And, of course, I should ask you about the raincoat, Columbo's raincoat, which I believe you bought.
Mm. Well, there was a dispute over that because I...
What, over who really bought it?
No, the dispute was... I always said that I read that in the script, but Lincoln Levinson said, no, it wasn't in the script. But I seem to remember seeing it in the script, so whatever it is. I did buy it, but I didn't buy it at the time. I had already had it, but I said, this is what I want to wear. And I knew what I wanted to wear underneath it, too. I wanted everything to be tan and brown altogether. A little dash of dull green in the tie. And that's about as flashy as he got. And the suit that fitted me the least was a seersucker, kind of seersucker blue and white. So I said, dye that. And they dyed it and got out all that white, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember, but it had to be dyed. And that became tan, and the shoes were mine, too. They were a pair of shoes I picked up in Italy, I don't know, a long time ago. They happened to be fairly expensive shoes, handmade shoes, but they were very comfortable, and they were clunky.
And that was important, clunky?
Clunky was important, yeah.
For that sense of being slightly uncoordinated?
I think you always wanted that contrast because the people that he was going after, they were always...
wealthy.
They were always, yes, God's chosen.
I right. mean, they
all had long necks and they all could buy suits off the rack and it fitted them and they looked good and... their teeth were white, and they had dough, and they spoke well, and so clunky shoes were a good contrast.
I have one more Columbo question for you. Do you think that your long association with that character has worked for you, against you, both, in your in the other part of your career, the part outside of Columbia?
Well, I always say the same thing, Terry.
Say it again.
I'll say it again. Being known as Columbo, and it ain't cancer. So, I mean, I make a lot of dough, and the listeners, you know, I think it's difficult for the average person to say, what's he complaining about that he's typecast? Who the hell cares? I mean, he does make a lot of money, and he gets good seats in restaurants, and so I don't feel that that's something that people are really interested in. But to answer your question, I think arguably I probably would be a better actor if I hadn't spent so much time playing that one role. I think that kind of diversity and that kind of challenge, I might be a better actor. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think probably I would be. But so what?
I want to ask you, you have a glass eye. And I think that happened when you were three. You had a tumor removed.
Yeah.
And I guess they removed your eye, too?
It was a malignant tumor.
Do you think that that's that you've made that work for you as an actor to affect your image, to use it as something that looked menacing or that made you look more vulnerable?
Well, none of that was consciously. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing that I would be aware of when I was acting was a try to avoid looking 100% wall-eyed. I mean, so that if you were to look in one direction and one eye went all the way to the left and the other one was still in the middle, I try to avoid that. But I have never consciously felt it, though I'll use it in some way.
Gee, could you not get shot from certain angles because your eye wouldn't move and that would be the only eye on camera?
I'm better off from the left side. I think that minimizes the wall-eyed thing.
Mm-hmm. Did kids pay you to look? You know how kids are.
That would have been good. No, they never did that. Now, when you were a kid, you know, I used to dread that moment when somebody would say, what's the matter with your eye or something like that. And there was a turning point, I don't know, when I was 12 or 13 years old. I think it had to do more with playing ball with the guys, because once you started knocking around with those guys, they were so open about it, and they would say it so freely, and it was usually a gag or a joke or knocking you or whatever the hell it is, that by then it didn't mean anything to me anymore. I was very comfortable with it.
Did it interfere with
it? Because I realized, yeah. The other thing is, then I realized I could get a laugh with it.
No, did it interfere with anything that you wanted to do?
No, not at all. No, I think one of the main problems with the eye was the fact that my mother would, if I'd go play football or whatever sport, she was always nervous about it. And I always thought that was ridiculous, nothing to be nervous about. You know, when you're that age, nothing can happen to you. And then you could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the first night, I remember the first night I was in a Merchant Marine. There was this black guy from San Francisco. I think he was from Oakland. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. We just had shared this forecastle together for the first night, and he was sitting up in the top bunk opposite me, and I came in and I sat down. It was already very, very late, and he had his pajamas on, so I started getting undressed. At that time, I had my front teeth were knocked out, and I had a removable bridge, so I took out that bridge and put it on the table. It had a nice sound effect, a little clunk when that went down. And then I popped the eye out, and then the glass hit the tabletop. That had a nice sound effect. And he's up there. He's up there watching me. And then I bent over, and I started unscrewing my knee. It was a gesture, you know, where I started turning it. And it looked like I was about to remove my leg. And I always remember him saying, excuse me, I'll be right back.
Peter Falk speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. The first season of Columbo has recently been released on DVD by Universal Home Video.